Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are opening up a book that really served as a moral wake-up call for the entire American conscience. Michael Harrington's landmark 1962 work, The Other America.
Yeah, it's a powerful one. This is the book that basically forced a nation to look in the mirror. You know, in the post-World War II era, the story everyone told was about incredible national success.
Right.
The U.S. was this engine of global prosperity. You had the invention of the suburbs, the consumerism boom. It was the era of the affluent society.
That's the key term, isn't it?
Yeah.
The affluent society. It kind of created this illusion, this idea that everyone was benefiting equally from the boom.
And Harrington just absolutely shattered that illusion.
He really did. He documented a truly shocking reality that, well, completely contradicted the national myth. At the height of America's wealth, you had 40 to 50 million Americans, that's almost a quarter of the population, living in severe entrenched poverty.
And this wasn't just, you know, a temporary downturn or cyclical unemployment.
No.
This was a permanent structural crisis hiding in plain sight. So our mission in this deep dive is to really understand Harrington's concept of invisible poverty.
Yeah, and uncover the deep systemic reasons why this inequality was so easily ignored back then.
And crucially, why applying this kind of lens is still so important for understanding economic precarity today.
Definitely. So let's start with the man who wrote it. Michael Harrington, born 1928, died 1989. He wasn't just an academic writer.
No, not at all. He was a political scientist, a really prolific writer, and also a passionate democratic socialist.
And for listeners who might not be familiar with that term, think of someone focused on achieving economic democracy, right? Strong welfare programs,
yeah.
Equality, but through political action, not revolution.
Exactly. And what really set Harrington apart, I think, was that he wasn't just writing from some, you know, comfortable ivory tower.
That's right. He had the high-level intellectual training. He studied at Yale Law, University of Chicago, big names. But he paired that academic rigor with really crucial grassroots experience.
Yeah, throughout the 1950s, he worked with Dorothy Day.
At the Catholic Worker Movement.
Right, in New York City's Bowery, which was, well, notorious.
Absolutely.
And the Catholic Worker Movement, their whole focus was serving the neediest people, the homeless, the mentally ill, the desperately poor. Harrington was literally living alongside the people he eventually wrote about.
So that mix of like deep intellectual thinking and direct personal immersion, it let him frame poverty in a completely different way, not as some kind of individual character failure, but as a deep structural flaw in American capitalism itself.
Precisely. So when he published The Other America in 1962, his goal wasn't just to, you know, document a problem. He wanted to create a political and moral imperative.
Yeah, shock people out of their complacency, shock the middle class, shock policymakers out of this comfortable assumption that poverty had basically been solved.
And his central thesis is just so powerful and, frankly, unyielding. Poverty in America isn't some marginal issue. It's not an anomaly. It is systematic.
It's built in.
Yeah, it's perpetuated by institutional barriers, things like racial segregation, poor school funding, technological displacement. All this creates what he famously called a vicious cycle of deprivation.
The book itself reads almost like a journalistic roadmap, doesn't it?
It really does.
Harrington takes you on this tour through these hidden landscapes, the hollows in Appalachia, the crumbling inner city tenements, the brutal exploitation of migrant farm workers.
And what's fascinating here is his argument that poverty in the modern era had actually changed. It wasn't like the very visible poverty of the Great Depression anymore.
Right. Everyone saw that.
Yeah. Modern poverty, he argued, was characterized by its invisibility and also by its intergenerational persistence. It just kept going.
Which led him to conclude that the scale of this crisis needed a huge response.
A massive federal response. He actually said it needed something on the scale of the Marshall Plan. You know, the money the U.S. spent rebuilding Europe after the war, a Marshall Plan for America's own poor.
Wow. Okay, let's unpack the mechanisms of that invisibility. He starts with this idea of the invisible land. If America was doing so well, why couldn't the middle class see all this poverty?
Well, partly they literally couldn't see them because they drove right past them.
How so?
Think about the rise of suburbia, right?
Yeah.
And the creation of the massive interstate highway system. These new roads often bypassed the inner city ghettos and the rural slums completely. So the poor were geographically segregated.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. But just as crucially, he argued, they were politically invisible.
What do you mean by politically invisible?
Well, they weren't organized. They didn't have a lobby in Washington. They didn't have a collective political voice. Harrington pointed out, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but basically, if you don't vote, you don't donate to campaigns, and you don't organize as a pressure group.
Then policymakers aren't going to pay much attention to you.
Right. They'll prioritize the needs of the groups who do have that kind of clout. So the needs of the poor were just perpetually overlooked.
And this ties directly into who these new poor actually were, particularly the ones pushed out by technology, what he called the new class. These weren't like the immigrant poor from earlier eras who maybe had a pass up through factory work.
Exactly. That's a key distinction. The new poor were often workers whose unskilled or semi-skilled jobs had been permanently eliminated by automation and industrial shifts.
Obsolete.
Yeah. They were basically deemed economically superfluous. They weren't just waiting for the next factory job to come along. Many lacked the fundamental skills needed for the new economy. This kind of structural unemployment was way more insidious than the old cyclical kind.
Okay, but let's get into maybe the most controversial, but also critical part of his argument, this idea of the culture of poverty, which he talks about in the chapter, The Twisted Spirit. That term has become really loaded since the 60s. Did Harrington handle that carefully?
He absolutely did. And this is where his intellectual rigor is so important. He described this culture of poverty, you know, a life maybe marked by fatalism, a feeling of helplessness, maybe a focus on immediate needs over long-term planning.
Right.
But he was crystal clear. This culture is a rational adaptation to living under constant structural deprivation. It's not the original cause of the poverty itself.
Okay, so what you're saying is, if you're trapped in that vicious cycle where maybe every effort you make seems to fail because the system's stacked against you, then planning for retirement, or even planning for next year, might feel totally pointless, maybe even illogical. You focus on getting through the week, right?
Precisely. Yeah. That's what makes it self-perpetuating across generations. Like say, he famously put it, the poor made the mistake of being born to the wrong parents in the wrong part of the country.
Because they had zero control over
it. Exactly. If your success or failure feels largely predetermined by these outside structural factors, then why bother trying to save or make long-term plans? That's the twisted spirit he was describing, a spirit twisted by circumstance, not inherent character flaws.
Beyond that automation trap, Harrington also detailed some really specific demographic traps. One was focused on what he called the minority within the minority, African Americans. Their poverty was unique, he argued.
Unique and magnified, yeah. Because every barrier other poor groups faced was compounded for them by systemic racism.
Right.
You had segregation in housing, which meant worse neighborhoods, worse schools. You had inferior educational funding, outright discrimination in hiring and wages. So, while maybe a poor white family in Appalachia faced terrible isolation and lack of opportunity, a poor African-American family faced all those issues plus this constant institutional hostility at almost every single turn. It made escaping poverty vastly harder.
And he didn't just focus on urban poverty or Appalachia. He also spent significant time looking at the exploitation in other sectors, like migrant farm workers.
Yeah, a group often completely left out of policy discussions even then.
Still happens today.
It does. He described their conditions as almost feudal. They were landless, constantly moving for work, lacking basic labor protections, often living in terrible housing, with no stable education for their children, just trapped, despite doing incredibly hard, essential work.
And he also highlighted the elderly poor, didn't he?
Yes. The Golden Years chapter.
Yeah.
Millions of people who had worked their entire lives but were living in destitution. Why? Because Social Security benefits were often inadequate, healthcare costs were rising fast, and they were stuck on fixed incomes.
So if we kind of step back and pull these threads together, there seem to be maybe three core messages that really stand out and frankly still shape how we talk about inequality today. The first one really challenges the whole foundation of the American dream. Poverty is structural.
Yeah, that's the monumental takeaway, I think. Harrington's book is just this ongoing, powerful challenge to the narrative that poverty is about individual failure or lack of effort.
Right, the bootstrap idea.
Exactly. He shows it's a product of systemic flaws, technological change leaving people behind, deep-seated discrimination, institutions that just fail the most vulnerable. And that leads to that devastating quote you mentioned.
Yeah, let's repeat that one because it's so stark.
Yeah.
The real explanation of why the poor are where they are is that they made the mistake of being born to the wrong parents in the wrong section of the country.
I mean, that's just a damning indictment of any simple idea of meritocracy, isn't it?
Absolutely. Okay, the second core theme seems to be this concept of political powerlessness. Harrington argued that social indifference, basically ignoring the problem, is much easier when the victims have no voice, no political representation.
Yeah, that political invisibility ensures the cycle just keeps going because lawmakers, politicians, they have very little incentive to prioritize the suffering of people who can't pressure them.
Mm-hmm.
He captured this perfectly, noting, the poor are politically invisible. They are not organized. They are not a pressure group. Their problems get ignored precisely because they aren't organized into a force that can demand attention or accountability.
And finally, the last big theme, the one that gives the book its title, The Two Nations. Harrington essentially synthesized all his findings to declare that America had fundamentally split.
Yeah, split into one prosperous nation, the affluent society, and this other America, poor, often despairing and separated from the first by this huge structural, social, and political wall.
And that goes back to the geographical segregation you talked about earlier.
It's a direct consequence. Modern poverty is easy to avoid seeing if you're in the prosperous nation. Harrington wrote, and this quote really nails it, "The other America, the America of poverty, is hidden today in a way that it never was before."
So the very fact that it's socially and geographically segregated makes it easier for the middle and upper classes to ignore. But ironically, that same segregation makes it even more deeply entrenched and harder to escape for the people actually caught within it.
Exactly.
Okay, so this book is, what, over 60 years old now? But its application today just feels incredibly stark. For you, the listener, engaging with this book really demands, I think, a shifting of your personal perspective. It forces us to stop defaulting to that bootstrap mentality.
Yeah, it really does. We have to understand that systemic barriers, things like having an eviction record that blocks you from housing, crippling medical debt, just not having reliable transportation to get to a job, these are often the primary drivers that keep people trapped.
It's not just about trying harder.
No.
Yeah.
And understanding that has to lead to, well, greater empathy, sure, but also, crucially, to demanding more effective systemic policies.
And we can also use Harrington's lens, his way of seeing, to identify the modern invisible poor. Who are the new poor right now in our time?
That's a great question to ask. You might look at, say, the gig economy worker who has no benefits, no safety net.
Or the college graduate drowning in debt, working 3 part-time jobs just to scrape by.
Yeah, or entire communities still struggling with the opioid crisis, or decimated by factory closures decades ago, with wages that have just stagnated. They're often functionally unseen and unprotected by our current labor laws and social structures.
Which leads to the final and maybe most important application, a call for systemic action. Harrington was really insistent that private charity, while good and necessary for immediate relief,
It helps people survive.
Right. But it doesn't fix the underlying structural mechanism that keeps creating poverty in the first place. He demanded something on the scale of a Marshall Plan.
Yeah, massive coordinated action.
So following his lead, we need to advocate for comprehensive, large-scale systemic solutions, right? Mm. Things like massive housing reform, maybe universal healthcare access, targeted adaptive job training programs that actually address the technological displacement happening now, just like he addressed automation back in 1962.
Yeah, for me, my lasting takeaway is that Harrington's most enduring insight is that poverty in a wealthy nation like the U.S. is essentially a political and a moral failure. It's a choice.
A choice. How so?
Well, we have the resources, the wealth exists. What's lacking is the collective political will, the social commitment to actually implement the comprehensive solutions needed to dismantle these structural walls he described. It's a result of social indifference and neglect, ultimately.
Wow. And I guess my takeaway is just the sheer astonishing power of rigorous analysis when it's combined with real moral urgency. Harrington made the invisible visible. He didn't just describe it, he made people feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, he fundamentally changed the national conversation. His book directly contributed to President Johnson launching the War on Poverty initiatives a few years later. That, to me, is the true measure of a world-changing book. It didn't just explain the world, it helped to change it.
Well said.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.